Aloha and welcome to Deep Dive into Water Safety. Today we're joined by Dr. Kanisa Duncan Serafin, a marine scientist, educator, television host, and one of Hawaii's most accomplished ocean athletes. Kanisa is an eight-time Molokai to Oahu paddleboard world champion and a member of the Hawaii Waterman Hall of Fame. She is also Associate Director for Education with the University of Hawaii Sea Grant College Program and Director of the Center for Marine Science Education. Many people across Hawaii also know her as the host and producer of The Voice of the Sea. What makes Kanisa's perspective especially valuable for this conversation is the combination of science, education, and a lifetime spent in the ocean. Today, we're going to talk about what it really means to be ocean competent, how people learn to make good decisions in Hawaii's waters, and what we should be teaching our children and visitors, and how Hawaii can build a stronger culture of water safety. Kanisa, welcome to Deep Dive into Water Safety. It's a pleasure to have you. Let's
Mahalo
just
for having me. But I'm nine-time champion now since last week.
Well, do you want to explain that now, or do you want to talk about that and paddle for life?
We'll talk about it in the paddle for life.
Okay, that sounds good. Let's keep everybody interested in this conversation. So let's start out by your experience. You've experienced the ocean as a champion paddler, educator, and television host. How have those different experiences shaped the way you think about water safety? And was there a particular moment in the ocean that changed the way you thought about safety and what happened and why it stayed with you?
Those are great questions, Margaret. I was born in Canada in what I thought was a landlocked place, but it turns out that recently I discovered that there's a lot of water there in lakes and in indigenous people who lived on the water. And actually my father flew planes, so pontoon planes. They land on the water during the summer and then they land on the ice during the winter. So of course there had to be water, but having not grown up there, I thought I came from a landlocked area. So that was kind of exciting. This last semester, I had to do some work for my Hawaiian kumu, and I found that out by talking to my mom and looking at some old photos. And so that was really neat. But then subsequent to that, I learned to swim in California because they gave free swim lessons to all kids under five. There was this man, Frank Whedon, who thought everyone needed to swim, and that changed my life, right? It sent me into becoming a swim team person, and I swam competitively. I swam in college, lifeguarded, and then came to Hawaii to study fish and things that live in the water. So I think all of those experiences, lifeguarding myself certainly changed how I feel about ocean safety. But probably the thing that I would think of the most, like the most moment in time, was a paddleboard race. And it was the Klein Man Ko'olaupoko race, which is named in memory of this amazing waterman, Klein Man. And it goes from Makapu'u on the windward side of Oahu to the leeward side. It finishes at Kaimana Beach. It's about 16 miles. And you go along what people call the wall, which is between Hanama Bay and Wanalua Bay. And it's kind of rough water there. And so I was racing my friend Eric, and he ran into a rock along the wall and knocked off his rudder and had a big hole in his board, and so he needed help. And I flagged down the escort boat, and so they helped him. And then I keep paddling, and there was a giant, giant tiger shark that came up right next to me, and I was like, "Oh, no problem! Like, it's a race. There's escort boats. There's one right there. I just saw it." And then I could see the two boats, and I was like, "Hey, hey, hey, guys!" And no one came and no one cared. And so I put my hands on the board for a second, and then I was like, well, like, just keep moving, right? Because you don't really want to be a sitting target. And I think that that really clarified for me, and other moments like that where I've been out in the ocean and things aren't going quite right, and I really feel like you need to have the ability to save yourself. Like, you either need the technology, the tools to be able to get in touch with somebody. Like, are you carrying an EPIRB or a phone that you can use on the water? Or can you swim? Like, do you have a life jacket? Can you make it to shore? And that you need to be responsible for yourself in those situations.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But you mentioned the ninth race, so let's just get right into that. Paddle for Life, Kalani Vieira, Chief
Yeah.
of the Guards at Kauai and Waterman Hall of Fame himself, amazing athlete and president of
Amazing
the Hawaii
athlete.
Lifeguard Association. You know, walk the walk, because we have the highest drowning rate, second highest in the country, and young children are drowning at a high rate. We have visitors who are drowning while they're snorkeling, and so we need to get those drowning rates down. We shouldn't be having this. We have a very elite group of watermen and watermen on this across Hawaii. So you showed up at this third leg
Yeah.
that was last weekend. That was pretty tough. You want to talk about how you got involved, why you got involved with this? Because it wasn't a race, it was for drowning
No.
prevention awareness.
When Kalani was planning his paddle for life, he suggested that I join him on the last leg because he thought I'd come on my paddleboard and I'd be a little bit slower. And he's like, "Oh, by then I'll be out of energy and you might be able to keep up with me." And he'd had at different times, like maybe he was going to do it all alone, or maybe he was going to have a crew of people join him at each component. And I know there was a send-off leg. So when you donated, you could check a box. Did you want to be signed up to have a leg to paddle with Kalani? And I took my paddleboard because it was, I don't know, it was pretty fun just to go out there and show like a different craft on the water. But also fun for me because I just won the Molokai to Oahu race the week before, and I hadn't seen Kalani yet, so I paddled out, and it was pretty hard to find them. They were moving a little slow the last day. We had a really big east swell, and then we had really strong east wind, and they were trying to come down the coast. So they had gone upwind for a long time in pretty big water,
Right.
and I was tracking Tyrus on the GPS, so I knew about when they'd be there. But then I saw the escort boat and I paddled up to the escort boat and they're like, "Hop on, we're gonna take you on board." And I was like, "Well, where are you gonna take me?" And they're like, "Well, we're gonna take you into Kalapaki." And I was like, No, I wanna find the guys." So I turned around and I paddled upwind. And it took me a while to find him. They were kind of offshore, like a few miles of searching. And then I found him and that was really cool. But then I saw Kalani this week and he's like, "Oh, when you were coming," I was like, "What is that? I don't know what that is. I just saw pink." And then it was Kinesa. And it was pretty neat. Like they were, I think it was a real emotional like down point of the entire paddle around the island because it had been such a hard day and it was the end of their third day and they still had, 12 miles to go when I found them.
Yes. Yes.
And
That's what
so
we heard.
I felt worthwhile in like that I brought something to the table, because we were able to have a moment out there and I had fresh energy, kind of pumped them up and they kept going.
So you just won your last Molokai prone race. Is that what you're saying? Last week?
Yeah. And I hadn't done it in 10 years. There were a lot of really fast women who, like, to be re completely fair, didn't show up. You're only winning the day of who's there, and there are some amazing young women who I'm sure would have blown my doors away. But it was still pretty special to get to go back. I hadn't done it in a decade, and really grateful for everybody on Kauai, my family, but also my friends who helped to support me and get me paddling again, and
Yeah,
I got my
everybody should
best
know
time too, which is kind of cool.
you live on Kauai, correct?
I do, yeah, the
That's
east side.
pretty special. So you're an athlete, a major one. You're an educator, a major one. We need to talk about that. And I want to know, you just explained to us that the incident that you remember was coming across a shark, right? And nobody there to help you, and you need to be competent in the water. So, what do you mean
Yeah.
by that, Kanisa? What should people know? I mean, we talk about people need to swim, but what is water competency to you?
I think first of all, as you're saying, it's swimming, and like my children know how to swim. And it was hard. Like my second daughter, my biological daughter, I have a stepdaughter and a biological daughter, and my biological daughter did not like a wet washcloth touching her. She had a lot of skin sensitivity. I had a hard time putting her face in the water, but I started taking her to the YMCA when she was a little baby and signed up for the mommy and me classes. And I needed someone to help me put her face in and they break through that barrier. And now she does swim team. She's 13 years old and she's a little swim racer. And like, she's not the fastest girl on the planet, but she's certainly competent and she can boogie board and she can surf and she's safe in the water. But I think it begins in flat water, a pool or a lake or, near to shore where there's not waves, where you can learn how to move your body in the water itself, in that element. And then in order to be competent in moving water, like whether that's a river or the ocean, or a lake that has wind or has currents or has tides, then that it becomes more like also a mental process of, I think in Hawaii we would call it kiloing or observing over time, but also learning from other people and then spending time in that environment so that you understand the different conditions.
Right.
I
Or
think that's, yeah.
you can say more. Go ahead. I didn't mean to
I
interrupt.
think maybe I'm getting ahead to your next questions, but I think
Yeah.
that's often why people get in trouble in our waters here because they don't always look super dangerous, or you see, small kids, 8, 10-year-old, just being able to traverse the shoreline in and out of the water very easily. And I don't think adults give enough credit to kids sometimes who've spent, they've spent their 10,000 hours in that environment learning how the water is moving. And even though they're very small or they don't have many years, they have a lot of experience.
Well, that's a good point. Time on the water is very
Yeah.
important to understanding, and that kind of goes with the cultural point of Hawaiians and part of our way of life here. But how do we move from, as you said, people should have swimming lessons, but what is the other bigger piece of understanding the ocean and all that is in it, rip currents and the ocean itself, and when you should go in and when you shouldn't go in. Because I know the swimming lessons teaches you a skill. Does it go beyond that? And should it go beyond that?
I think swimming lessons are the first step, right? And the Kauai Lifeguard Association is now offering free swim lessons in
Right.
Lihue at the YMCA, largely because of Loola Aiea, and the Kauai Lifeguard Association. So I think that that's really fundamentally important to be able to swim, and I think it also comes back to culture too. I've had the privilege of doing some travel to the outer Pacific, and I see that in places where the culture is still tightly tied to the water for sustenance, for, cultural reasons, that the swimming tie remains. But in places where they're more reliant on canned food or Western foods coming in on a boat, that then they've lost their connection to swimming. So literally in some places like American Samoa, for example, where they wanted students to start surveying the reefs in the nearshore environment, the first thing that they had to do is like institute swim lessons. And the first time I was there was, maybe 15 years ago, but now it's totally transitioned where the people taking the swim lessons to begin with are now the ones that when I went back recently, are teaching swim lessons. And there just needs to be that connection and that generational connection, and a purpose for being in the water, on a local basis. But then I think if we talk about our visitors, that's a different animal.
It's a very different animal. But before we talk about our visitors, let's talk about education. You're an educator, you do curriculum. K through 12, is that correct?
Yeah, we did
As a
K through
professor?
12, and then I would say that our Voice of the Sea shows like for those students, but largely we really make it for adults. So in our classroom testing, and it's paired with curriculum, it does well, but we were really hoping that adult learners will choose to watch it. So it's on TV, it's on YouTube, and the idea is to take research and science that's happening regionally and bring it into people's lives in an accessible way so that they don't have to, read a scientific paper or get all your science from social media.
Right. I
Although
listen.
we put some of our stuff up on social media too.
That's good.
Yeah.
So let's get back to what are safety.
Oh, but I have one other thing. Like, I think if we're talking about what do you want to learn about the ocean? Like, there's so many different ways to learn about ocean conditions and how to be safe on the ocean. And maybe in an ideal world, everyone could have a person, a mentor that would take you out and help you to learn firsthand. But that's just not available to everybody. And so I think like what we have in our curriculum, we have lessons about rip currents. We have lessons and worksheets, multiple worksheets in Ōlelo Hawaii in English for students to go to the beach and observe. And what do they see? They count the sets to measure the height of the waves, to learn about beach slope or like what types of sand are in different areas or what's going to make a bay, for example, have a higher run up in the tide than a flat place if you're in a tsunami. So that there are other ways to learn about ocean science and ocean safety, even if you're not near the ocean or you don't have a person who can teach you, on a one-on-one basis.
I agree with that. The UK got water safety into all of their schools based on a framework and a pathway on a developmental level, starting from the age of 3 all the way through high school. And it's in every discipline. It could be in math, it could be in science, it could be in literature, it could be that. So you're telling me you have that in your Sea Grant program or in your.
We do in our we have two curricula that are housed through the University of Hawaii Sea Grant College program. One is the Exploring Our Fluid Earth, and that's aligned to 6th through 12th grade standards, both Hawaii and the next generation science standards. And then we have a grade 3, 4, 5 piece that is really tight. It's a much smaller curricula, and it's very targeted at that next generation science standards and what do teachers need to work with students on, or where in those standards is the ocean really critical? Like, you need to understand the ocean in order to be scientifically literate in those standards.
Well, that sounds great. Is that part of, as far as I know, it's not part of the Department of Education's curriculum?
No, we made it outside the DOE. We've had many or various DOE science specialists actually helped write the curriculum and then went to work with the DOE. It's freely available, but it's not adopted, but it's not prescribed by the state of Hawaii.
Well, that sounds like it should be. I mean,
Maybe.
we've been talking this talk for about a year because we started this with the water safety plan, and one of those issues was back bringing water safety education back into the school. So I interviewed Sam Johnson from the UK, and that was just approved, and it goes into all the schools starting in the fall of 2026. And what that framework is pretty much what you're talking about. It's developmental, but it goes through all stages, all pieces of course material that you have in each grade, and then decision making about water safety, what you should be doing. And they pretty much laid it out and gave examples. So I sent that to George Centeio. I could send that to you also.
Yes, please. I'd love to take a look.
Yeah, you would find it very interesting based on what you're just telling me. And I think that's very important because I agree with you. Everybody should know how to swim. We live on an island. This water survival skills are important because you can be a great swimmer and still drown.
Yeah.
But I think these things are important because if a child is getting this at an early age, it becomes a systems approach to water safety. And it also is something kids learn and then come home and talk about it. So the
Right.
parents now know that this is an important piece. We should all be paying attention to this. And maybe it ignites them to learn more or get their kids swim lessons. But since it's not in the school system, which is a place it should be, we're surrounded by water. We should become really the leaders in water safety, in my opinion. And I think the school is the best place to start very early. And you, as an educator, you know, at the university, you probably agree with that probably wholeheartedly, right?
I definitely do. I think right now we're still in a situation where it's very difficult for teachers to take their students to the water. There are some exceptions for water below your knees, or if you have, many lifeguards at a time,
Well, I
if you're
think
in
you
a
think
DOE
outside the
school.
box. At least you get them reading about it. You get them doing the science behind it. You get them
Right.
doing the math behind it, so they have knowledge about what's going on and, you know, just behaviors to change their behavior. So I'm going to ask you that question. You're doing the Voice of the Sea. You're putting out just remarkable information. Has that changed people's behavior, do you think? Do you think?
So I think if you're going to talk about a sliding scale of effect, right? Like first is just awareness, and then you want to build knowledge, and then can you, at the end of the day, change someone's behavior? And that's a really difficult thing to assess from a TV series. So what we've done is ask surveys, like pre and post. We'll get a group together and watch the episode or at a public screening. And then we've done some focus groups too to talk with people about, before watching this episode, for example, on wastewater issues or water conservation issues, how likely are you to install native plants in your yard or to use a rain barrel or to vote for water conservation measures? And we do see improvement across our episodes. So I think that we're making a difference, but I can't say for certain the number of people or the percentage who've watched our episodes and then, make an ecological shift or a behavioral shift in what they do on a daily basis. But I, because of the limited amount of data that we do have, and we've done it in many places and with lots of different people, I think that we're chipping away at those behaviors, and that and the programs like ours, or interventions like ours, or curriculum, experiences that students have can effectively change behavior.
Well, I think you're onto something. Data is really important, and we don't have a lot of data. We have, when you're talking about drowning prevention, we have no non-fatal drowning data, and our drowning data is very scattered and not, you know, organized into one place. So that becomes hard for a priority for a state to say, should we be putting our resources there if we don't have the data? Right. So it's interesting to see that you've done pre and post and focus group work. I think that goes along with swimming. I think it goes along with some of the program. Every program that we have, we should be doing pre, post, and whatever, because that's the kind of data you need to get resources. You know, you're a researcher in an academic field, you understand how that works. So, what do you think? Should we be doing more?
Well, absolutely, but I also think sometimes, we can study a thing to death, and it's a question of where do you want to put the resources? Like, do you want to put the resources into the lifeguards themselves? You can hire a whole another position, or we could study how we're doing it. And so I think that there necessarily has to be some benefit on people's just their ike, like their knowledge over time, right? And what they know. And you talk to someone like Kalani Vergara, and maybe we don't need to do a study to validate what he's saying because he's been looking for 30 years, right? But in other cases, like maybe with our drowning statistics, it would help, or with visitors, with people that we don't know so intimately, like before and after their visit? Why did they have certain behaviors? Why did they go to unlifeguarded beaches? Like, why did they ignore the film that is at the Lihue Airport? Could they not hear it? Could they not read the subtitles? Were they just so ready to get their luggage? Like, what
Right.
is it about these preventative measures that we have that people aren't paying attention to?
Right. I agree with that. So let's talk about that messaging for the visitors, because I just thought, well, maybe we just get some students to stop people as they're leaving the baggage claim and say, did you see that video? They say yes, ask them what they remember, right?
I think the video is hard to watch in the baggage claim, honestly, because sometimes the audio is not working. Sometimes it's really screechy. When I go in and it's working well, I'm like, wow, the video is working. But then I don't know that people really have enough time to stay there, and they usually seem pretty scattered. For a long time, I've really wished that we could, on all of our incoming flights to Hawaii, have both water safety, environmental stewardship, cultural kinds of things, and almost have, like, I don't know that money needs to exchange hands, but I would like for there to be a pledge that people take that they agree to act in a certain way. And I think that those things can go a long way toward good behavior, especially if there's a group, and a family's certifying and children are saying, I'm going to do this properly, because they tend to hold the adults accountable.
Well, that goes to two messages. One, that we're trying to get a message to people before they ever step on foot
Right.
there. And the second issue that you've talked a lot about, I think, is you have to have aloha aina before you malama aina. And that, I think people will protect and care for what they feel connected to. And that
Right.
connection creates kuleana. And so, if we can get those messages out to people before they get here, so they're thinking about how important it is. The mayor came on the show twice, and the second time he came on is that he said, visitors are welcome into our home, right? And when you're welcome into our home comes responsibilities. And I think that's an important piece that we're not talking. We're telling people they should, stay calm, stay out of this area, don't go in the water for this. But we're not giving them the message that they could be respectful of this. It could be something they could be part of, therefore care about it, therefore make better, safer decisions.
Right. And then, if you look at just messaging in general, it's really interesting the research that's been done, for example, with hotel towels and hotel towel reuse, right? And so if it's a positive message, the social pressure is helpful. So if you're saying, 70% of the people who stayed in this room reused their towels and we saved all this water, and you hang that sign up, then
Yeah.
in research, people are more likely to do that, follow the behavior, and also save the water and reuse their towels. On the other hand, like, the National Park Service has done work, like, in the Painted Desert, where they're like, people who are, they're stealing your petrified wood, they're taking your heritage one rock at a time, and that doesn't work. And then people all go off the trail and they all start stealing rocks, because, like,
Right.
it's a vanishing resource. On the other hand, if you just put up a sign that says stay on the damn trail, people stay on the trail. And so I think we're confronted by two realities, right? We want to say, like, stay in the safe water, and that's just the shortest message possible. Like, be safe, don't be an idiot. And then we also want to have this, like, longer, more involved message where we have some reciprocity. And so I think we probably want both, but I do think they are somewhat competing ideals.
Interesting. So if we start with the airlines, and
Right.
I'm on the Water Safety Committee for the Hawaiian Coalition, maybe you should help us, because Duane DeSoto added, we need to get back in the airlines.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think that's now that Hawaiian and Alaska are merged, maybe they have some breathing room to see that this is an important issue. But your idea of a pledge for water safety, right?
Right.
That's really a good idea. And with stewardship, conservation, all those things could be all part.
Right. I think it makes it, you're not going to solve 100% of the problems, but I think you're going to make some progress. And then if that's paired with other signage that's just like, this is dangerous, right?
Right.
Don't go in the water here. Then you have some prevention, like overall umbrella type prevention, and then you have prevention at the areas that are the most dangerous.
So let's talk about water sports and water safety because there are world sprints in Singapore this middle of this month, and they're very
Yep.
strict about their water safety.
PFD required.
Yes. So let's talk about water safety here in Hawaii. We've got outrigger paddlers, we have surfers, we have prone paddlers, we have foilers. What can you tell people who, I mean, there's lots of us who are experienced doing it and we have safety issues. And then there's canoe clubs, right? Do we have enough water safety, or what do you think should be in a water safety plan? Because that's one of the pieces for the water safety plan, that canoe clubs should have water safety plans. So what's your take on that, Kanisa?
Not running any canoe clubs myself, and I'm actually doing a bit of canoe paddling right now, but I hadn't for years. I guess I just hadn't paddled really for years. I'd been
Yeah.
more surfing and familying. I can tell you that my personal water safety plan on my paddleboard, so I can't carry a PFD on me. But my board is a PFD in a way because it is foam, and so it doesn't sink. And then I always carry my phone with me, and I have somebody who knows where I'm going, and they can track me on my phone because we have pretty good cell reception now. And I carry a whistle, and I also have a smartwatch which can also make an emergency call. And so those are my personal safety things. And if we're doing something that's more involved, we have those bright plastic tapes and stuff that you can roll up and carry with you because you want to be able to make a bright spot on the water. Like I wear bright colored clothing. And then I think when you get into the races, a lot of them now are requiring PFTs, and there are many that are made that are really low profile and easy to wear. And I had a discussion with my good girlfriend on Maui recently, and she's a really excellent swimmer. She does lots of open water swimming, but she has a PFD for the Maui associations require them for the one man and kayak races. And so she has one, and she was talking to me and her husband about how do I wear this thing, and wouldn't put it on. Like I would just swim without it, and then I'd put it on. And then her husband's like, no, the reason you have that thing is so that you don't get tired out swimming, or that by the time you get tired out, you're still going to be floating.
Right.
And so we had this real kind of deep conversation amongst the two of us girls who done a lot of offshore stuff without a lot of safety equipment over the years, And so now we're where the safety equipment is available. I mean, then there are cell phones, there are these small profile PFDs. And
Yes.
how do we incorporate that into our ocean going lives in a way that still feels comfortable, but is going to get used in the moment that you need it?
So you mentioned Maui in the OC1 races is requiring PFDs. Do you know if that's true here in Kauai?
It's not, we don't.
We need to work on that, Kanisa.
Well, I don't know. I enjoy not paddling with one, honestly. So I think like there's. I don't own one, because
Yes. Well,
like
you
I said,
are.
my paddleboard floats,
Okay, so
but
Kanisa,
I'm just, yes.
you are a eight-time winner of a major race, and I'm talking to an audience of people that maybe are recreational, don't do that much paddling, are new to the
Absolutely.
sport. So we need to talk on that level, okay? I mean,
But
I
I think that's the problem, is because like we come on and we talk, or they see people like us, or they see those kids that I mentioned, and we can do things because we've done them for a lifetime, right? Like if I can swim for 10 miles straight, then I'm not as dangerous if I'm offshore by a mile, right? But if you can't do that, or if something were to happen to me, like if I were like I've lost friends who've had heart attacks and things like that.
Yes.
And so medical emergencies can happen to the best of us, and you cannot be prepared for that. And so I think we all do need to up our game. And that was part of the discussion that I had with my friend about the PFD, because like I've just come back into other types of paddling, or into paddling in general, really. And
Right.
so what is it that I need for myself to keep me safe? And maybe it is I need to go get a PFD, right? And start wearing it.
I'm glad to hear this because the World Health Organization says everyone can drown, but no one should. And Mike
Right.
Phelps was on our island, right? He's like Olympia, right? And he's out talking about water safety on lots of shows. But he had a major incident here. He got in trouble in the water. And I can't think of somebody who's more competent in a water than Michael Phelps. So I think
Right.
that's very important. And so the question goes back to water safety plans. We could all say that we know how to be safe, but shouldn't we have things kind of written down so new people coming into the club could understand? Because you've
Yeah.
spent thousands of hours on the ocean, and that's not going to be because we have new people moving here, people that are just joining sports. People who are out there and visitors who may see you on your prone board way out and go, well, I'm going to rent one of those and go out and do the same thing.
Right. And I think like vice versa is also true. I got myself in trouble in a river because I didn't understand how it worked, right? And so we floated across a couple times and it was all good. And then the people I was with floated down to a rock and climbed up to it right before it went over the falls. And I floated down to the rock and I went to try to grab, and it was so slippery and the current was moving that I would have gone over, but my friend reached up and grabbed me. And so I think it was because I was not, and this is back when I was in college, but I had already, swum and lifeguarded in lakes and ocean and stuff. And the guy who saved me was not as good a swimmer as me, right? And so it's not always about your capacity. A lot of it is the conditions. And so like you're talking about Michael Phelps, or but not necessarily being familiar with ocean conditions in Hawaii and how things change. So I think like those guidelines are really important. And the question, in addition to making the guidelines, is how do you encourage people to pay attention to them and really ingest them? Because like even as we're talking about the PFD, like I'm like, I don't want to wear a PFD, right? Well, like you have to be very honest about that. Like otherwise everyone would be wearing them. Like they're expensive, or and you have to put it on, or like is it going to go around your waist? And if you're going to wear it like that, like on my paddleboard, I couldn't really do that. But in a one man or a kayak or a six man canoe, it's quite comfortable. And in those situations, it's actually maybe also more needed. But like I have a leash on my paddleboard now, and I have a plug for my leash, and I didn't used to have a leash, but it's become they didn't ever make them with a place to attach it. Right? There's no place to anchor the thing. And so over the years I've done like the sticky leash plugs and stuff, the ones that you epoxy on, they come off. And so but like we're evolving, right? Like I've been doing that sport for almost like 30 years, so
You're
I
exactly
now have
right.
a leash.
We're evolving in water safety also because the conversation has become more and more of something. And
Right.
Alyssa Magrum, who represents the National Drowning Prevention Alliance, did the first leg with Kalani on a stand-up board, which was totally glassy, right? And
Yeah.
in that segment, somebody who was on a one-man got hit by was it a swordfish or what it was, and put a big hole in his one-man. And so he was close enough to Port Allen to get in. and he really didn't have anything to stop it up, I don't think. So that's another issue with the one man. You can, you know,
Right.
animal can take
Exactly.
out.
Yep. I've been on the ocean with hollow crafts that have been cracked in half before. Yeah. And you have to swim it in. And that can be really a lot of work.
Okay,
And
so
that's a positive situation because you recovered the craft and you everything.
I just want one thing to say to visitors about water safety, and then I want to go on and talk about Ciguatera because local people have asked me about your research on that. Okay. What do you want to say to visitors about water safety? You know, as you mentioned, there's lots of people in the water who are watermen that are just experienced. I think they should be listening to those people. I think we all have a responsibility to tell visitors things if we see something or help them out. But what's your take as an elite athlete?
I think swim at lifeguarded beaches and ask the lifeguards.
Okay.
The lifeguards are so knowledgeable, and I see them all the time interacting with the visitors, and they're kind and helpful, and they're going to point you to the place on the beach that's right for your ability, and they're not going to look down on you because you don't swim well or you don't have experience. They want you to have the best time that you can have. Yeah.
That's exactly right. I hadn't spent much time at Poipu, and I was just amazed at the guards and the amount of activity that was going
Right.
on between stay away from the turtles to you don't have your fins on snorkeling. And that's another question. We could get to that briefly. Visitors have a tough problem snorkeling. What advice do you have for them? Because in my conversations internationally, people are saying it's not a toy, it's a respiratory device.
Right.
And you know, Nikki Roderick, who does Free Dive Safe and is doing such a great job and tried to get some legislation about labeling on free dive equipment. It's the same with snorkeling, it's a respiratory issue. So, what do you think? I hope we can get some legislation this time around on those kinds of things.
I think that's a fabulous idea. I've in my marine science education career, I've taught a lot of snorkeling. Taught kids to snorkel and then taken them snorkeling, taught young adults to snorkel and taught my daughter to snorkel, my mom to snorkel. I think it takes some work, and I think it's another one of the sort of romanticized ideas we have about Hawaii, that you're going to come here and then you're just going to do all these things. You're going to hike to the top of the mountain, you're going to put your face in the water and see all the fish. So really it's about going to a safe place, and then it's about the labeling and talking to people, and if you're renting gear to have them help you. I mean, one of our most dangerous places in Hawaii is Hanama Bay, and they rent snorkel gear there. They have many lifeguards there. They have, stewards of the place who are interacting with the people, but because there are just so many people at any given time, all with their face down in the water, it's very hard to tell who's in trouble and who's not in trouble.
Well, I had friend Ralph Godo on, and I told him maybe he said we need more research on this snorkeling, and I said, well, I think the perfect pilot is Hamana Bay, right? I mean, why not find out why that's becoming an issue if we have real education there, and people are getting to re why is that be why is that a problem? I figured that's the best place to study what's going on with snorkeling. Would you agree with that, or do you?
I think to some extent, I think they have a slightly different clientele than maybe some of our other beaches. And in talking with some of the lifeguards there, I think culturally, some of the visitors who come to Hanama Bay are reluctant to make noise or make a big stink if they're in trouble. And so the lifeguards feel like some of the people who drown, like who actually drown, didn't signal themselves that they were having a problem because they didn't want to cause a scene.
Oh,
And
interesting.
so I think that's another issue, is if you are in trouble, you need to make big noise about it and get people's attention because everybody's and also everybody there's concerned with themselves, right? Like they're all everybody's maxed out in terms of their cognitive load. They've got the mask, the snorkel, the fins, they're trying not to step on the reef. They've got their daughter, their mother, they want to take a picture, you know.
It should be interesting to see the type of mask that's being used, and the difficulties people have. That's a piece of information we really need because people have come on and talked about full face masks.
Yeah.
A woman in Italy, Dr. Trapani, has made it her case to say no one should be using those, and there should be regulation on that by weight, not by age, just like a car seat, right? So
Oh, interesting.
yeah. And so she got the Ministry of Italy to actually start some discussions with the full face mask producers. So that was pretty interesting because of her work as an ER doc.
Yeah.
And so I think we could do some of that stuff here. I agree with you. We don't have to research it to death, but we're not making much headway with this snorkeling issue, in my opinion.
You know what's interesting? I think the shipboard snorkeling tours and stuff are much more successful because they do have that captive learning environment where they can do environmental stewardship and cultural kinds of education also because the people are trapped there on the boat and they kind of can't get in the water until, you know, the captain or the stewards release them. And so I think they do more effective, probably more enjoyable snorkeling than a lot of our shore-based visitors who are going out by themselves. But it's probably not a thing that we can legislate that you have to go through a snorkel training or something before you can go in the ocean, unfortunately.
I think I go the way of the respiratory equipment, that it's not a toy, and that manufacturers should have some responsibility, and they should go through just the kind of thing that scuba equipment goes through, right?
Or even like our pajamas, right? Like a kid's pajama that'll tell you like you have to wear this tight or it's not fire retardant and just a tag you have to take off that explains safety.
I'm all for this. So let's move on. You've done some good research on Ciguatera. So
So it's
tell
not my
me.
research, but we covered it in one of our episodes.
Well, tell me something about that. What are you doing in that area? And what should people know about fish that they get, fish that they buy off the side of the road? Whatever you want to say.
I think what the side of the researchers are coming down on is that it's really hard for the to get accurate test kits. So we had some test kits in the early 2000s, and they not only gave false positives, but they also gave false negatives. Which and in the case of Ciguatera, if your test kit says it doesn't have Ciguatera, and then you eat the fish, but it had Ciguatera, that's a terrible outcome. And so our tolerance for that false negative is just very, very low, effective tolerance for it.
So are you telling we don't have accurate Ciguatera tests?
We don't have accurate test kits that are portable that people can just have on their boat. They have to go out to a lab, and so that's why people aren't passing out these test kits. And so in researching it, what they've found is it like the Ciguatera is caused by a dinoflagellate that like a swimming unicellular microalgae, and it tends to grow on like fluffy kind of detritusy, sort of not as clean of little other algaes, right? It's like an epiphyte. So it grows on top of other things, and it grows on in areas where like again, there's going to be like dirt and stuff getting in and on that algae. So if it's very clean water and very clean limu, the risk of Ciguatera is less in general. But what they're trying to come down to is like, can they test the algae and look for dinoflagellates in specific areas and do that quickly, and then come up with a rating system where, like, it's a yellow day, it's a green day, it's a red day, and so that you know where you're fishing. But it really takes some intimacy with the place that you're fishing, with the species that you're catching, and then the species that you're eating. So if we talk about fish on the side of the road, you're not as familiar. But most of the fishes that harbor ciguatera in an amount that would make us sick or more, they're the more reef fish kinds of things that people aren't selling so much anymore in the market. They're more subsistence fishing or fishing, you know, you give it to your friend, that kind of thing. Because our open ocean fish, our ahi or mahi, are not particularly ciguatoxic.
Oh, I didn't know they could be. Could they be?
Apparently they can be, but I think it would be very, very rare.
Okay, so I have friends that are local fishermen, and I told them you were coming on the show, and their first response was, "We need ciguatera kits." I didn't realize that we had none that didn't work. I thought maybe I'd be asking you for some.
Yeah, that as far as I'm aware, they're not cost effective. Like, even the researchers who are working on ciguatera are not sending out all their samples to determine if it has the toxin in it.
So what's
So
the odds of catching fish that have ciguatera in?
I think it depends on where you are and what species again. So we know, like, for example, from the North Shore of Kauai, like Kole, tend to be hot, right?
Okay.
And so people are largely aware of that. And then in that case, they're either not eating a lot of it, they're not eating the head, they're not eating the fatty parts, because that's where the ciguatoxin is going to accumulate more readily. And then you're just kind of not overdoing it on your fish consumption, because the ciguatera poisoning also tends to affect people more and more over time. It's not something that you get accustomed to, rather, it's something that tends to build up in your system, or your response to
Reaction.
it builds up.
Right? Yeah, that's interesting. And there's no antibody or any anecdote for this at all.
Not that I'm aware of, and the researchers that I have talked with have all experienced it for themselves. And so I think, you know, as much as anybody, they want to stop it, and for a lot of them, that's how they got involved. And there are sort of urban myth ways of testing your fish, but
Well, I would think Nikki Roderick would be on top of that since she's free dive safe, right? She's all into that. I haven't asked her about that, but that's an interesting piece that I don't spearfish or any of that, so I just know someone who did have a bad experience probably 15 years ago on the North Shore, and he was lucky to actually survive that and come out 100% whole.
yeah.
That was a miracle, I think.
Actually, after we made that episode, I was in Fiji on a different project working with some teachers there, and I ate a clam with a Fijian woman who harvested it for me, and I was very excited to eat that clam, and it was one of the best experiences I had on the trip until I got really sick from it, and I'm pretty sure it was ciguatera. So I have experienced it myself also
What are the symptoms of
in a
ciguatera?
fairly acute way.
We'll
Well, it
move off this topic, but what are the symptoms of ciguatera?
lot of it's a neurological thing. So a lot of times headache, and then one of the textbook things is like reverse hot and cold. So things that are hot seem cold, things that are cold seem hot. And just a general like malaise and weirdness.
Interesting. Okay. So, Kanisa, what is the next
Oh, and I guess
plan?
that's another misconception, because I was saying I got it from a clam, but in a lot of places, like in Samoa, for example, like octopus, lobsters are really hot, hot meaning they have a buildup of the ciguatoxin in them because of what they're eating, right? So like it accumulates in the food web, and we tend to think of it as in reef fish, but it can accumulate in invertebrates as well.
And so you're saying in Samoa and where else? Where you were?
Oh, I was in Fiji.
In Fiji. Okay. Is
But
that
I was
where?
in a very dirty area, a harbor area. In hindsight, I think about that clam and I wonder why I ate it.
Because you're adventurous. I can tell this. You're the woman that's totally prepared for the open ocean and wins like race after race. So, I'm looking for you to talk to our, general listener who is not the elite athlete and how to enjoy the ocean and what they should do to stay safe. So, is there anything else you'd like to say?
I think the absolute first thing is just spend time to look. I think we are ocean athletes, but maybe people ignore the preparation that goes into even every little paddle that I do or other people do. We're looking at the surf reports, we're looking at the wind models, we're at the beach or driving to the spot, looking like viciously the whole way, really paying attention and talking to other people about what they've seen and what do they know, how was it yesterday. And I think that's really hidden in our culture, and that if we can convince people to just stand on the shore and spend 10 minutes, you're on a 2-week vacation, spend the time to look around and see what's happening. 20 minutes, half hour, like our sets sometimes take that long to come through, and that we're doing that work, even if they're not aware that we're doing that work. And so I think that that's kind of a hidden thing that comes into every time I go out in the ocean that might not be seen by other people, but is critically important and affects my safety and affects my decision of where I'm gonna, if I'm gonna go and where I'm gonna go,
Well,
right?
you just named a couple of places to look. It'd be nice if all that information was in one place so people could pull that up and know this is what's happening in Haneley Bay. This is what the currents look like. This is what's going to happen. All in one place, not in different separate places, which you're aware of. I use also. But for people that aren't that ocean savvy, that I think that would be really great information to have it in one place.
The Kauai Lifeguard page is pretty good. And then the PAC-IOS, the Pacific Islands Ocean Observing System. So they collect across Hawaii and they'll model the surface currents and it's completely free. So other things like I subscribe to Surfline, which is a subscription, or you can look at some of the NOAA models are free, or the Windy app is free. But I think the PAC-IOS, PAC-IOS.org, so it's PACIOOS.org, and it a lot of my professional paddling friends use that now also because their coalescing of data is so good and their algorithms to like map the surface currents and things are so good.
Is that something? Well, I'm talking about visitors right now. Would that be something a visitor would be able to interpret, somebody that doesn't
Well,
know?
it's I think they're beautifully interpretable now because they're just maps with colors and arrows,
Oh, okay.
right? So you can see the size of waves or the size of wind or the direction of current just in the colors and the arrows. And I think like we're schooled enough in interpreting maps. I would hope that, most people could get something out of that. We should link to it on the Kauai Lifeguard page.
Yes, I will do that. That makes total sense. Anything else you want to add to the Kauai Lifeguard Association website? Okay.
The Swim Kauai Aquatics Program in Lihue, get there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We should do that, and maybe we should have your show on there. I think your show is great.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And the work you're doing. I mean, people are busy. They don't have a lot of time. And it's great, I think, if we could get one place where all the information is for people, that would be for visitors. And as you said, we've got to do something before they actually step foot here. People are talking about that all the time. And so hopefully you could help us with the airlines, Kanisa.
Happy to. Let me know all of your tricks and we'll get in there. We need the contact person.
We do need, I think you have lots of context, Kanice. I think you have to work on this. I think it's the biggest push we've got to help visitors, right? To understand that they're coming to a place. And if I think your idea of the pledge makes total sense for water safety too, the whole thing. So
Awesome. Let's do
did we
it.
miss anything else? Is there something else you want to talk about? Because
No, I
I'm
think I just love the water so much, and I'm grateful that you're having this show podcast to talk about how people can enjoy it safely.
Yeah, we're trying to give, research, evidence-based research, so people can make better informed choices. And so experts and elite athletes are part of the equation, but you tick all the boxes, right? You're an
Yay.
athlete, you're a researcher, and you're an educator. So, and we're trying to talk to people around the world because we can, I think we can collaborate on what's going
Yep.
on because drowning's a global issue. We have people coming from all over the world. We go to all over
Right.
the world. We're not just staying in one place. So the more we
Right.
understand what's going on in different parts of the world, I think we can learn. I think having Bruce Hopkins here was great. And the Okinawan lifeguards has been a big piece for everybody to understand what's going on there. And Taisho Tono has made a lot of progress. He's worked on it for 20 years, and now he's got government support for more lifeguards there. And I think that has a lot to do with Kalani going and collaborating and giving them the skills in,
Right.
water patrol.
And our lifeguards are such professionals, and they
Yes.
work, it's year-round job, and it's they're not paid enough, and they're not recognized enough
I agree.
as the first responders that they are.
I agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It shouldn't just be a resolution. They should be, acknowledged for what they're doing all the time. It's very
Acknowledge and also provided time
safe.
for training, because
Yep.
they're not really provided time for training, and so all that has to happen on their off time, and they
Definitely.
already work such a physical job.
Right. Every time we lose a life or a non-fatal life, that is an economic issue. And it affects the entire community, not just the person, their family, but the community. And it's in a huge expense. We all know that, right? So investing in the people who are the frontline first responders, our lifeguards, makes total sense.
Right. But I think part of the reason we don't have data on it is that the data makes people uncomfortable, right? It's the same with the shark attack data, that you want to bury that stuff because you don't want to alarm the visitors. When on the other hand, like what we kind of want to do is have them sit up and take notice and realize, like, you're coming to this place. Yes, it's beautiful, but it's also pretty thorny. And
Right.
what's
And
your A game on?
I go back to what you said. I mean, ask a lifeguard. I mean, that's the best thing you can do. Go to a guarded beach if you've never been here before and don't know anything, not comfortable. It just makes total sense because they're trained and they know everything and they can help you make a great vacation, right? And not
Right.
one.
And they're not gonna, make your time terrible, like what you're saying. They're gonna help you make it better.
Right. They'll tell you where the best places to snorkel are the best places to surf are, depending on your level. They know all that. They know where the rip current is, right? But I agree, we need to elevate them to the level that they are. They need the benefits and they need the training. That's ex
Absolutely.
exactly right, Kanisa. So we have to work on that.
We'll save the world.
Maybe. I don't know. Well, is there anything else you want to say? What are you planning
Mahalo,
to
thank you
do?
so much for having me.
Yeah, I know, but what else are you up to? I mean, you're at the university
Oh.
now or not?
Yep, I'm working on, we just did our Voice of the Sea YouTube premiere for
Right.
our most recent
Lahaina.
episode about Lahaina coastal recovery.
Everybody
We
should
are ac
see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And then our next episode's actually about wildfire prevention in Hawaii. So that's going to be a very informational episode about, what things people, communities are doing, can do. How do we know what to do to prevent wildfires from spreading through our infrastructure?
Yeah, you need to do one on floods.
Yes, we do.
Okay. All right. Well, I will put that on a link on the show. And I think people could get on YouTube and see this also, right? Okay. That's very good. Okay. Well, I'll thank you and I'll end this. Kanisa, mahalo for joining us and sharing your perspective that comes from so many parts of your life, scientist, educator, communicator, paddler, and someone who spent years learning from the ocean. One of the important ideas from this conversation is that water safety is much more than knowing how to swim. It's also about understanding conditions, knowing your own abilities, making good decisions, respecting the ocean, and knowing when not to go. If Hawaii can bring those lessons into education, recreation, competitive ocean sports, and the way we communicate with visitors and residents, we have an opportunity to build something much bigger than another safety campaign. We can make ocean competency part of how we live with the water. Thank you for
Awesome.
coming on. We will
Let's do
talk.
it. Okay. Bye.
I Bye.
Aloha.
It was nice to talk to you.